about things that are going on in Portland, Oregon. Before I get into those stories in particular, I'll be talking a little bit about the sense of the context as far as the city repair project in Portland, Oregon has been perceiving it. And what I mean by that is in the work that we do in the Western city, city, there are a set of challenges that are kind of inherent to the process of sort of waking up late in the sort of the late stages of westward expansion. James was talking a bit about how Latino culture, because it has certain indomitable, unforgettable, irrepressible patterns, it in many ways tends to transcend. The patterns that have been laid on out on the land that don't admit or include some really essential ways that human beings interact. Space hasn't been made, place hasn't been made for the things that people want to do. And some of that's intentional, unfortunately, as I'll be sort of discussing in a second. And that's the nature of colonialism. It's not an accident that public squares are missing in almost every single neighborhood of this city, Portland, Oregon, or Seattle. It's just part of how the grid and everything that goes along with it is designed, unfortunately for us. But it presents a great noble challenge to undertake on behalf of ourselves and our families and our larger communities to start to get a grip on, you know, what exactly is happening to us. It's a fact that we experience a more acute form of social isolation than most other countries in the history of the world. According to the research we've done in city repair, we've found that there are fewer outdoor gathering places per capita than any other nation in recent human memory. And that has to do with how colonialism happened in this landmass. We know that the Spanish were laying out the grid in Central and South America, but there was a difference between what they were doing and what was done where we live here. In the Law of the Indies, which was a lot like the National Land Ordinance of 1785, laid out by the Continental Congress, at least in the Law of the Indies that was promulgated by the Spanish, there was at least a provision in every case, in every sort of colony, that there would be at least one plaza or zocalo. And in the case of North America, or rather United States and Canada as well, no such provision was made. So you find in Portland, Oregon, we have a public square downtown, but it's only 15 years old. It had to be retroactively installed. So we find ourselves in this time when we've, you know, for generations been maybe taking a vacation to travel to other countries to get a sense of, you know, a kind of exposure to indigenous culture in some fashion, to go experience maybe the lands of our ancestors, in particular to see the common realms, the artifacts, the artwork. And then we come back, and it feels as if those places are richer. And I think more lately, people have started to realize, wow, there's a reason why we come home to a place that feels more devoid of cultural expression. I think we've been saying to ourselves, well, we're a young country. It takes a while to get culture started, but actually I don't believe that whatsoever. I've been to too many cultures and interacted with too many people now to buy that. I think, in fact, that cultural expression is immediately unleashed if it gets half a chance. Unfortunately, when it comes to the grid, it tends to be set up in a way that defies the convergence of people. It tends to not admit for communication, and I think I'll just start getting into slides and say more about that. Okay, so I just want to remind you of a few things. This ancient village understanding that is kind of a little distorted in our time, it goes like this. It's who you know. In a competitive society, as you try to climb the ladder, there's this notion that it's who you know that enables you to climb the ladder. But that's a distortion of a much more ancient village-based understanding, which is that you know people, that you have relationships, that you build social capital or social capacity, and it's through, you know, the building of relationships that everything is enabled to happen, the sharing of ideas, sharing of resources, finding the ones or one that you love. It's the way that families, you know, sustain themselves. It's the way that an entire society can be sustainable through an emphasis on culture building, through relationship building. Okay, so this old village understanding that the public realm was supposed to be about facilitating communication is something that, you know, it takes the director of planning bureaus or the heads of schools of urban planning to now tell us again, because we've had to study it so hard. I mean, as if we've lost this understanding. So Carl Abbott, who's a professor in Portland, says, in the broadest sense, the goal of urban planning is to facilitate communication. I mean, why don't we already know this? And then there's this other saying, Italians actually have songs that actually sing this, that everything goes on in the piazza. You know, and if you wake up in the morning and you don't hear people out in the public space, something's wrong. Songs like that. In fact, probably every culture has in some distant past, a more recent past, every culture has sung songs like that. You know, that the commons has to be filled with the vitality of local culture, and if it isn't happening, something's gone wrong. But you can also say that if everything goes on in the piazza, that if there's no piazza, maybe nothing goes on. Unless, as James points out, your cultural patterns are indomitable, and you go on, you know, even misbehaving in order to express yourself, you know, even, you know, to transcend the lines. Okay, in the case of those of us that live in the Western USA, I mean, we're already familiar with westward expansion. Yeah, you go out west as fast as we can, exploit the natural resources, you know, subsume the indigenous people that stood in the way, that were already there for thousands of years. And what a lot of people that were moving out west didn't understand was that they were moving into an infrastructure that had already been laid out on paper. And it was the idea of the Roman city-state, the civita, in which you would lay out a gridded infrastructure in which power would be held in a concentrated place. And then the working class would live in this sort of gridded placelessness in which they would mostly toil but not build culture. They'd be mostly sort of relegated to tasks. And then the city was an administrative center for the larger gridded landscape. People coming west didn't see the lines, but the lines have been drawn nonetheless by certain wealthy gentlemen on the East Coast. And then the military went westward to do their bidding. Their reward, of course, was to be able to then claim squares in that gridded landscape. So I'm going to contrast landscapes of participation that are really manifest through dialogue and interaction over time with landscapes that are really driven by policy and that don't reflect participation. One thing I want to just remark about early on is that I'm sort of talking about democracy. It's really important for people that live on this landmass to consider, because we keep hearing that we live in a democracy, and yet the deme of the city is missing. And what I mean by that is that the model of the Greek city in which democracy was supposed to be happening was made up of cells that were sort of at the village scale, and all together they comprised the city, but each deme was a village scale in which people, or rather Greek men, had access and were able to participate. So that was the model. And of course that was based on much more ancient villages that had been, you know, conquered, and village cultures that had been lost along the way. But when you look at the typical American city, the deme is missing. Like, where is that village council that is empowered to make decisions at the most local scale? As we know in American cities, you've got to ask the mayor or the city council for a speed bump, you know, to slow traffic. And in the meantime, we wait and wait while they tell us that there isn't enough funding or there isn't enough personnel to serve us. And what's really missing isn't the funding and the personnel, it's the democracy to be able to directly address not only our own problems, you know, but to be able to just dance in the streets, to be able to interact in the commons in the way that we choose to any given day of the week. All right, so I'm not trying to romanticize the village whatsoever. I'm not trying to say, you know, for instance, this is Perugia in northern Italy. I'm not trying to say that this is perfect, but I am saying that the people come outside every day and into the night. They live above the shops where they either tend to own or they tend to work there. and they come out into the commons and they wash like a great tide from one piazza to the next throughout the day. And just by coming outside to go, you know, to go get bread or flowers or fruit or what have you, they just interact, they see each other, and they don't have to talk about building community, they simply build it by coming outside. And yes, cars drive through the streets, but they don't tend to mow everyone down because they know other people there, they have a relationship. Okay, so this is about participation, and I'm not saying there wasn't a king or some oppressive landlord or baron or something that walked this street, these streets at some time, you know, over time. I'm not trying to say that it's perfect in that sense, that there weren't dominators, certainly there were. But as opposed to this, where they've been walking these streets over time and building upon, you know, successfully upon previous efforts, here, in this case, none of the people who have ever lived on this street or who will ever live on this street have ever had a say in how the lines would be drawn that basically are the foundations for how they interact. You know, none of them ever said, for instance, you know, what fun, let's have a vote. Let's vote on whether or not to make this environment utterly, you know, bilaterally symmetrical, not only east and west, but north and south. You know, for every in the case of every street across the entire city, and every single city from the Ohio River all the way to the Pacific Ocean. You know, no vote was ever taken. None of them ever said, hey, we don't need those village squares anymore that we used to have, you know, by the dozens in our village. Let's give them up so that we don't have even one in a typical American neighborhood. And not only that, let's give up our power. Let's no longer have the deme or the local engagement. Let's give up our power to people we'll never even meet that reside downtown. Let's just say that, you know, bureaucrats in the Department of Transportation can tell us how we'll live here or not, even though they may never have even stepped foot on the street. You know, what fun. Let's set back from the property line all in a regimented fashion, sort of standing at attention. Was there ever such a vote? Of course there wasn't. You know, one of the most crucial factors about this is the intersection. You know, in the Italian piazza or the Spanish plaza gets to be a widening or a place of convergence where people's lives come together and they can interact. But in the grid, the intersection doesn't get to be such a place. Okay. Well, some people say, now hold on, that's just a car landscape. No wonder it works that way. But actually, the Roman colonial grid was laid out in this country long before cars even existed. It's a really important thing to understand. Because as we talk about trying to change the paradigm or make the world a better place, we have to understand that there are certain things about the infrastructure that we inhabit that will always frustrate our success in trying to change the world. Especially if we think that we have a sense of democracy here. Okay, to look again at the difference between a village and the grid, it's important for us, you know, when we're recreating our habitat to realize that, you know, humans are part of the ecology and they have certain basic elements in the human landscape, which consist of things like pathways, intersections, and blocks, just like you're familiar with on the right. But notice immediately at the block scale, okay, first of all, this is an aerial view of a Dogon village, and it works much the same way. I'm showing this because the essential infrastructure is a lot like sort of the archetype of the universal village. Intersections get to be widenings or places of convergence. In the centers of blocks, there are places made, openings made for people to interact. And what you're seeing here is a reflection of decisions that are made carefully over time, driven by social interaction. It's completely untrue to say that this is a planned landscape and this is not a planned landscape. This is planned through participation carefully over time. It's part of a dynamic process. This is laid out very quickly by somebody on a drafting board with a T-square who might not even know a thing about cultural patterns. So it depends on what kind of participation and planning you care about. So these folks don't have to talk about finding common ground. They simply are standing on it all the time, whether it's at the sort of familial scale or at the village scale where there's commercial and cultural sort of celebration and activity every day. And as opposed to that, at the block scale, it's simply drawn out of there. But you will not have an opening in the middle of the block. It's enforced by law, or it is by insurance companies. And this intersection doesn't get to be a place of convergence, but really maybe a place only of collision in our case. But that's the nature of the Roman grid. They were conquering people and then subjugating them, compartmentalizing them, converting the commons that they used to inhabit into a commodity, into a compartmentalized landscape that could be controllable. The new mayor of Portland, who used to be a police chief, he's very popular in the city, he was explaining recently that the primary utility of the grid is to enable surveillance by the police, by the military, so that you can sit at an intersection, which used to be a place, as I said, of convergence, but now it's just a checkpoint by which you can have surveillance over everything, which is part of the reason why Western cities have been so flat. Okay, and yet, in a certain way, we are all still villagers. Like when you count, when you sing, when you open a door for a friend, when you provide someone with a chair, in any way that you are, you know, expressing concern or care, or when you share, these are the sorts of things that we learned how to do as a place-based community that we never necessarily gave up the notion that we would be part of a place-based community where we would have a voice. Yes, many of us uprooted ourselves to leave where our ancestors used to live for whatever reason, you know, coming to this country because we had a sense of greater opportunity. But at the same time, there are certain human patterns which we choose, no matter what culture we come from, and it has to do with just recognizing the fact that the intersection gets to be a place where things happen. Whether you're talking about people that are rooted in place or people that move across the plains, in this case, the Lakota Sioux, you know, dragging their bivouacs behind them on horses, they find water, they create a great circle, and that gets to be sort of the breathing living room until they choose to move on. And it's basically an intrinsic pattern.
What was that image on the left that you remember?
That's an aerial of a village in Bavaria. It's about a third the size of a Portland neighborhood with many, many different, this would be called plots, embedded in the fabric there. You can kind of see them in different places, sort of sprinkled throughout. This is a geomorphic town. It's grown more carefully, adapting itself to the landscape over time. Okay, so let's see. This is an aerial view of sort of the typical American city landscape. This is looking at Los Angeles, the early Spanish colonial settlement that then surrounded by the grid. And this was laid out in just a few days by a military lieutenant, as I understand. And then it was parceled off for sale. And that's how Roman colonialism, American colonialism, worked. You rid it off quickly, you remove the indigenous people, and then the military, it's basically the garrison, the resident garrison, sells things off and becomes the new property-based ruling class that then rules the city into the future and becomes the Republican Party. So you drive through an American landscape and you'll see words like plaza, and yet it's only a laundromat, or village square, and they're selling, you know, any number of different things, a variety store. Here they're calling it a village inn, but it's really just a restaurant. And the reason that people are using words like that is because place names are very powerful. It's like saying to a bird, nest. You know, I mean, the bird's going to turn in there and want to roost. Okay, so where's the village? There are vestiges. Thing. As James was just saying a few minutes ago, Latino culture asserts it all over the place, in spite of the fact that it may even be a break of the rules. In Portland, Oregon, this place on Broadway, you'll find a little vestige of the village here. Like, here's a bench. Apparently, it doesn't cost anything to sit there, so it must be, you know, it must be some village vestige. So maybe you sit here and you look at the hedge for a while, the parking lot, the love sign, maybe you get inspired to travel to a real village. How it is. Like, where's the piazza? All right, so, I mean, understanding that, and then also understanding that social isolation is so acute in this country that it's actually a factor in influencing the crime rates that we experience, that in many cases, it's like 10 times higher in the United States, crime across the board, than other countries that we even have ancestral roots in. So it shouldn't surprise us that people smile, and walking by little girls that are just asking to survive to the next day. You know, we don't really see that we have a fundamental relationship and that she needs our help. Okay, and that's all real dire. I mean, that's the context that we find ourselves in, plus a lot more. We're not even talking about ecological destruction. Okay, so maybe, I think in a lot of workshops that we do in Portland and in other cities, people inevitably ask, like, okay, what happened to my village? What have we lost? You know, how can it be regained? And I think it's important to realize that there are some things that have been lost, but also there are some things that are inherent. You know, like, why should we not have a village center in which any child can be safe because she and her family have relationships to all of the other families around in that place-based community? Why should the elder be sort of farmed out to a place to basically die alone? Why can't they be in that village center where they all have a place and somehow they remain more vital because they're together? You know, why can't they have a relationship like this in which she can look into her eyes and know that she has heard her songs and her stories and the songs and stories of her mother and her mother's mother? Like, you know, she can look in her eyes and know that she has learned things that books can't teach and money can't possibly provide. You know, only through their direct association can these things be transmitted. You know, and then she also knows that she doesn't truly die in a certain way because she lives on through her. And that's the great promise of our culture. And I think that's the very foundation of sustainability. I mean, I'm all for bioswales and green roofs and everything, but, you know, to me, it's the fundamental connection between each other that helps us to care. And then in caring, we make different choices. So now I'm going to take you to Portland, Oregon. Portland's like a big petri dish. You probably heard that it's the most visionary, progressive, actionary, large city in the country. And that might well be true, but I'm showing this panorama to emphasize that the National Land Ordinance with its grid, the Interstate Highway Act, and many top-down decisions that have had a sort of grown our economy quickly as they were designed to do, but also had devastating impacts on the environment. These things have landed as hard on Portland as they've landed on many other cities. And yet something remarkable has happened. I'm going to use this sort of analogy of the revolt of the ponds for a second. Just reminding you about the 60s and 70s when people were standing up and just saying, wait a second, we're going to question what democracy actually means. We're going to speak freely. We're going to march in the streets. We're going to assert, you know, our dignity. We're going to be at least equal and perhaps unequal. We're going to stand up for the environment that we live in. Okay, so it's kind of like this. You know how chess is basically just playing war? It's just playing unsustainability. Like every time you play chess, you're saying, okay, here's some light ones, here's some dark ones. You know how to organize the board, because these are light and dark. You put them on, you know, opposite sides, they're standing on the grid, each one is in their box. And the way the game's played is that the pawns sort of go out, and they're very limited in their motion. They go out and then they sort of get annihilated, and then the taller ones behind them come at each other, and eventually it just comes down to the two patriarchs, and they broker a deal and get to survive, and the game starts again. So that's, you know, this is all about unsustainability because everyone's dying and everyone's falling off the board and the game comes to an end. All right, so one morning, they all woke up and they're getting ready to play the game again, and somehow during the night, a lighter pawn had gone over here and a darker pawn had gone over here. That's how I play. Start off that way. Okay, and then the pawns started to talk, like this pawn was saying to these other pawns, okay, remember how it went yesterday? You know, we threw ourselves against the ones on the other side of the board. We're all getting knocked off the board, and then the tall, oppressive ones, the funny hats, they came after us, and they were attacking each other, and then it came down to the patriarchs, and they brokered a deal, and now we're starting over again. The other pawns are like, what are you talking about? We're pawns. This is what we do. We stay in our box, we do what we're told, and we just clash against each other, and then, you know, and that's how the game works. And the other pawns are saying, no, it doesn't have to be that way. This is all unsustainable. If we don't stand up and somehow try to make a change in this, everybody's going to die, and that's how the game works. So somehow or other, they got into small groups, and they had facilitators, and they started to share stories, and they were like crying, hugging each other, and stuff like that. Then they went back to the back row, and they confronted their oppressors, and they were like, it was all this denial and defensiveness, like, what, us? Okay, so what ended up happening, though? So they started to undertake some ideas. That's what happened in Portland and a lot of other places. one of the first things we did in Portland, Oregon, was we ripped the freeway out of the west side of off of the west side of the river. Unfortunately, it landed on the east side. What we ended up doing was creating this almost mile-long public park that gave people access to the water's edge. At the same time, people were getting more aggressive about trying to clean up the environment. And this was all in defiance of the State Department of Transportation. It took a great sort of consensus grassroots movement to make this happen. And this sort of made us famous across the country, like, you know, Portland, Oregon's really acting up and, you know, sort of daring to try to change the world. We didn't know that, we just thought it felt good, and then we went downtown and we said, okay, let's make a change in the heart of the city. Well, right after MLK had been shot, there was a group of planners. It was actually the very next day, and they were sitting around having lunch, and they were just really, I mean, everybody was bummed out, and they were sitting there saying, you know, God, how can our culture possibly survive this continuous sort of, you know, wasting of our leadership this way? And one of them said, you know, maybe it's time for us to do something. Remember what JFK said about, you know, not asking what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country? And then this older planner who could barely speak said, you know what, I think this town needs a public square. And so they undertook to do this as an initiative coming out of the city government. They organized with people across the country and across the city. And on a weekend, without permission, they came out and painted the rooftop of this two-story parking garage downtown. And sort of was with the design of a proposed public square. They painted the car and the gas station, as you can see here. But the idea was to take space and make place, to make a really dramatic impact, even against the opposition of the mayor and a couple of city commissioners. What ended up happening was this sort of catalytic effect. Now, Pioneer Courthouse Square is a great, great idea, not just because it, you know, facilitates incidental gatherings, it's a meeting place, it's a great, you know, sort of setting for large-scale gatherings. Its most important function is symbolic. The idea that, wow, there's a place in the city where time and space is not for sale, where everyone belongs. Like, people were starting to use words like public living room. Like, coming back into the culture after it had been absent for so long, this notion that there's a place where everyone could belong. So out of this period blossomed cafes, tea shops, tea houses, community radio stations, cable access, food cooperatives, and farmers markets, and many other kinds of expressions of community and alternatives that started to offer people new choices. Also, metro regional government, where three counties all around Portland merged into one entity to oversee urban growth boundaries and wetlands, open spaces, and recycling programs. We stopped two freeways from cleaving the southeast part of the city into thirds, you know, destroying many, many houses and neighborhoods. We took the funding from stopping that freeway and we built a regional transportation infrastructure, including the first intercity rail car system built in the last 50 years. And then we took the rest of the funding and we made 96 neighborhood associations to engage the population in grassroots democratic action. Historic preservation is virtually a given in Portland, Oregon. Here's a warehouse that's been preserved, but it's also been turned into a large-scale green building prototype with living roof systems, bioswales, all kinds of wonderful things happening inside, including green-oriented businesses. The Office of Sustainable Development, which is part of the city government's house at the top. And then this is the Metro 2040 plan that is basically about containing growth and concentrating it along transit routes in a logical fashion. So what I'm showing you here is sort of not the most radical stuff, although to the rest of the country, this is pretty radical stuff. I'm just trying to encourage you to appreciate movement wherever it occurs across the spectrum, from the so-called left to the so-called right. All right, now I'm going to show you the work of city repair. This is definitely a more condensed version than people where were we yesterday? Santa Monica? That people saw there. But one of the things that's going on in city repair is that rather than being discouraged by the immensity of the challenge that we have to undertake, it's just to realize that change happens every day. You know, it's a function of the spinning of the planet, the seasons changing. So the question in city repair is, you know, how exactly will we change? How will we choose to change? And will we participate or will we not? So, sort of skipping a project here, there was initially a catalytic tea house that we built in a neighborhood that was kind of tuned to Portland culture, but it was based on some ancestral prototypes and it was a very fabulous little space. It was extremely inexpensive and made entirely out of natural and recycled materials, but it had the effect of kind of waking up almost an entire neighborhood around the issue of place. Some kids had been hit by cars trying to cross a busy street just to go to a place to play, and a lot of people were upset. Then this tea house was built that brought together hundreds and hundreds of neighbors, and it was based on the notion of sharing, that people would bring drinks, desserts, and just share them in this tea house, and it became a sort of fabulous catalyst for relationship building. Well, at a certain point, people started to talk about their entire neighborhood fabric, and here you have neighborhood historian Eileen Fitzsimons talking about the history of the grid, westward expansion, the history of the neighborhood, in particular the Selwood neighborhood. And they've got a model here where they're looking at an intersection, and someone has drawn a circle around the intersection, because what they're also talking about is the fact that in villages, intersections get to be a piazza or a plaza or what have you, and not where we live, not where we had lived. So people are getting rather motivated by realizing that it's a question of patterns, and it's also a question of participation. She's explaining that no one in the community had ever had a say. Because of the tea house, they realized that they could accomplish basic goals, basic livability benchmarks, like to build community by fostering communication, sharing, and collaboration, to provide a gathering place in a neighborhood forum, to enhance safety and livability, calm traffic, beautify, provide adaptable models. And they realized, just as with this tea house that they had built without permission of the city, without getting permits, that they could accomplish all of that just by taking direct action. So that was rather discouraging, though, because what they were talking about was taking the street and converting it into a people place. And that seems like a very daunting idea. Like, how can we ever convince the mayor to give us back a piece of the commons? Well, fortunately, there was a 13-year-old young woman there who encouraged everyone to just look more deeply into the possibilities or the consequences of undertaking this idea. So she created this little grid that identified what the breadwinners in each one of the rectangles did for a living. And this was the intersection that they were focusing on. And so pretty quickly, after about 2 minutes, the kids that were connecting the dots here said, you know, there's a carpenter, a contractor, another carpenter, a landscaper, a designer, a roofer, a plumber, an electrician, an ironsmith, and they could all be working together. A chef, all these people that eat, a social worker, all these people with social problems, a doctor, a retiree, a sick person right next door. And they realized, you know, it started to get so dense, you couldn't even read it anymore. And then they threw in the stay-at-home parents, they threw in the kids, and they realized, you know, that they basically had a village, but there wasn't the catalyst, there wasn't the village heart that would bring them together or enable them to just even know each other. So at some point in the discussion, somebody said, all right, so if somebody put a grid over the circles of our ancestors, by God, it's time to put the circle back. So one of the mothers at that meeting just couldn't wait, and she built what she called the 24-hour chalk station. Put some chocolate. Why not? You've got 24-hour gas stations, 7-Eleven. All right, so now you've got these indigenous villagers coming out to seize the commons, the Revolutionary Act. Surely the police are on the way. And then some other kids, utterly neglected, foster kids. A carpenter gets together with them, and in 2.5 hours, they create what they call the 24-hour library. And, I know this is very simple and humble, but it had an astounding effect on the neighborhood. I mean, suddenly all these people are coming to see this place, where books are just being given away, and people are like, oh, I get it, so I'll bring some books to give, and everyone's having fun, like, giving things away. So, again, it's the symbolic impact, even more than the function, that makes the difference, because suddenly people feel like the neighborhood's a safer place. So this seemed like a bunch of really great things, and we tried to have a dialogue with the Department of Transportation about this before we actually took the intersection illegally. Like, we had just had enough. And one thing I'm sort of omitting in the story here was that we were informed by a Native American roadman named Elk River. He was one of these guys, you might see them downtown in LA, they travel through, sometimes they use buses. But they have tool kits. If you ever see a Native American walking along with a tool kit, he's probably a roadman. Their job, as assigned to them by their native cultures, is to go out into the sort of European sort of colonial landscape and try to help wake people up, So we had the benefit of a road man named Elk Rip, who's very small. He looked rather like that character Yoda from Star Wars. He would just wander through the neighborhood every now and then. One day he stopped, and there were these kids drawing on the sidewalk and on the intersection here before this whole project started. They were drawing colorful circles. And he stopped and he said, "Wow, circles. What a great idea, circles." And he looked around and he's like, "Wow, why aren't there any circles around here? How come everything's so straight?" And, you know, he would ask questions like that and move on. And he would always leave people feeling a little disturbed and unsettled. Like, oh, wow, he was trying to tell us something, wasn't he? So he kept coming back and coming back. When it came time to build the tea house, he said things like, you know, "Okay, so if you really want to change the world, you've got to stop asking permission all the time. Because you're basically laboring under the assumption that someone else has power over you. Like, how can it be that you all live here, but someone else controls the place where you live?" He's like, "That's silly." All right, so eventually we kind of got to the point where we had a revolutionary awareness inspired by an indigenous shaman, if you will. And it led to stuff like this. So we called transportation. We said, "We've got a great idea. We think it'll really benefit the community." And they said, "You know, absolutely not. That's never been done before." Mm-hmm. And we said, no. It's happened all over the place. And we'd all heard from Eileen. She'd been telling us about, you know, grid fabric and village fabric. And then transportation said, "You know, besides, if we even let you talk to city council about this, they'll get mad at us." And we said, "Well, we're already mad at you." But of course, we didn't matter. We didn't have power, right? The Deme didn't exist. So, and then they said the thing that was just over the top. Elk River had actually said to us, "Okay, at some point there's going to be a line. You'll see it. It'll be right in front of you. And all you'll have to do is walk over it together. But when you walk over a line like that, not only for your own behalf, but for everyone, then things will begin to change." So then this is where the line appeared. Then transportation said, "And besides, that public space, so no one can use it." It was at that point where we were like, you know, the line was glowing. So we all just walked across the line. We began to build all these little structures, often in an adjacent yard, this family-sized bench, a little history station, the 24-hour tea station, a place for poetry, a kids' clubhouse, all these sharing stations, a stage, a little library. Okay, and the night before we did this, we just planted all these things out here. And our idea was, okay, human culture began like a garden. We were like planting seeds, we were cultivating, we had little starts, and we just added water and fertilizer, and we built with what we had over time, so the village heart can return in the same way. And then the next day, we painted the street, and we knew that we were doing this not only for ourselves, but on behalf of transportation officials, too. Like, after they saw this, and they were all angry at this, they were saying, "You know, you've got to get rid of that, we're fine you all, you'll all lose money, and we're going to intimidate you." And so our response was just to say, "You know, we're all missing a public square. None of us have one." And they would be like, "Oh," you know, because they were trying to fight with us. All right, so the day we actually painted, Ed, the simply enormous policeman, came driving down the street. He got out of his car, and he looked around and he just said, "I ain't touching this." And he got in his car, he pulled away, and he drove up the street, and he never even reported us. Okay, now remember, this, there's that old village saying about knowing people, you know? Like, it's that you know people. So we've been inviting Ed to our little tea house the whole time. And Ed knew the people in this neighborhood. He wasn't going to crack heads. He wasn't going to report us because he knew we were trying to help ourselves. All right, and make his job easier, probably. Okay, so here you see people doing this old European circle dance. And really the idea is just to get the folks together, give them something to do that's fun. And then they eat together, they dance together, they go home, and the next day they make new choices. And again, that's all about sustainability. The next day, maybe they'll want to do a bioswim. You know, the next day, maybe they'll want to build a straw bale building or what have you. But it's all about caring about the world and each other. All right, so a few families get together and they start to care about, I don't know, serving tea. So this is the solar-powered 24-hour tea station here on the corner, where the neighbors maintain clean cups, this pump thermos, you know, hot water in the pump thermos. There's a little poem on this heart here. It's all built out of recycled and natural materials. I think there were several different families that made this. It has this lovely inlaid mosaic little counter. Gardens start springing up on all the corners where before there were none. Okay, a lot of people ask us, what about the vandalism that occurs? I mean, you know, it must happen all the time. And actually, it doesn't happen. The idea was just to round up the criminals at the very start of the process before they could get away with anything. You know, we just said, okay, there's these kids with that look in their eyes. You know, they're going to just turn out that way. So here you got four American boys from four different families. You know, they're all used to being in separate rectangles, thinking their interests are separate, but they now own all these tables. They are standing on the piazza that they got to help to create. You know, we didn't have a budget at the start of this, so we asked these boys, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to build stuff here? What would you do? And they said, let's go to the beach. You know, let's bring all our families to the beach, and we'll go collect driftwood, and we'll come back and we'll build stuff. You know, I mean, the kids are just aching to have their families go do things together, but it rarely happens. So we went to the beach, and after about an hour, we collected all this driftwood, and then built, you know, we built this fabulous clubhouse around a living tree. And these kids now, you know, I mean, the place not only doesn't get attacked, other kids in the city are creating places for themselves. And I submit to you, one reason why kids attack the places where they live is because it's set up to not accommodate them. It's amazing how simply behavior can change. We just change assumptions and behavior ourselves. So this is a 24-hour communication station for birth notices, death notices. People do sort of spontaneous poetry on the chalkboard. Again, natural and recycled materials. But this is in the front yard where a person's given up some of their space. And so some of this is happening in the right of way, some of it isn't. Some of it's happening on yards where people are actually blurring the boundaries between themselves and the neighborhood, identifying with each other, no longer feeling so afraid. Pretty quickly, you've got three East Indian dancers that come skipping down the street to your potluck, start performing for everybody. But that's kind of how the whole process got started. When we first created that tea house, only about 25 people came, and then 35, and then 50, and then 150, and then 350, and then 500. And there were so many people, we couldn't even count anymore. They were not only packed into the tea house, they were sprawling out onto the yard, around the tea house, and then all the corners around this intersection were covered with people. And there were so many people there was nowhere for this dance troupe, the Gypsy Caravan, to dance. And that evening, the dancers were looking for a place. So people, just the neighbors, brought out orange cones and barricades. They closed the streets. They stopped traffic just to make a place. I mean, they literally took over the intersection. So the dancers danced for about 45 minutes, and then they brought the hundreds of neighbors into the space to dance together. And there was this great epiphany, this sort of beautiful kind of effervescence that happened in this neighborhood one night in the summer of 96. And that was the first claiming of the space. And then it's gone on over time to become even richer and richer. What happened very quickly was that the Department of Transportation was reprimanded by the city council and the mayor because we had managed to slow traffic, we'd managed to make the streets safer. All of these, you know, all the things we intended to do were done, and it didn't cost anyone anything. We just needed to have our power back. We needed to create a sense of place in the commons, and then it started to change just about everything. So then they legalized it, not only for our neighborhood, but for every one of the 96 neighborhoods in Portland to do to an unlimited number of street intersections. At first they said, okay, it has to have a maximum of 1,000 cars in a 24-hour period, which is actually not that many cars, you know, when you're not there during rush hour. Okay, and then they said, all right, this is working so well without stop signs, we'll up the limit to 2,000. Well, eventually they took the limit off completely. So it can be done anywhere in the city. Pretty soon you have natural building happening where people are using straw and earth and clay. I'll show you some examples of things that people have been doing along these lines. But of course, part of the process is to try to activate the inherent capability of the village that is resident here already but doesn't know itself yet. And so, you know, we've got some sculptors, artists, architects, and planners that come out to facilitate the rising, the arrival of the community vision. So they're saying the little pieces on the corners can grow, start to look like these sorts of objects. This is just conjectural because, you know, there's actually a lot of spontaneity. The ordinance that was established to let this happen is called the Intersection Repair Ordinance. After learning a lot about, isn't that crazy? But the city council had learned a lot about colonialism and how the grid defeats interaction. And so they said, well, repairing a landscape simply means re-engaging people and giving them access to the commons. So the ordinance mandates that people have to have, take responsibility, have to design and program and maintain this for themselves over time. I can't tell you how many hundreds of years or thousands of years, our people, all of our people, have been fighting to regain this kind of control over our own location. This is actually the smallest subset of government probably in the United States, and the only place-based one. Right? The people right around this space have direct authority over this place. They decide what happens and how it happens. So you repair the intersection by re-engaging, and that's what democracy was supposed to be about. Okay, so the neighborhood had this idea that, well, I mean, we noticed that the corporate media wasn't telling anyone what had happened. Like, the city council knew, a lot of neighborhood leaders knew, but the Oregonian, the major daily newspaper, and the TV weren't telling anyone that this new ordinance had been passed that allowed people to take the commons and recreate it. So we said, all right, well, then it's our job to take it out there and help people understand. So we created this rather bizarre vehicle. One tenth of the tea house, one of the tea rooms in the tea house, was placed onto the back of this little truck, and we sent it out to the rest of the city. It's called the tea horse, kind of like the Trojan horse. It moves around and it does things that are kind of unexpected. It takes people with it as it moves. And it was built for about $45. There was a derelict truck. One of the people living on the corners of the intersection was a mechanic, and he said, you know, I can fix that truck. And somebody was growing bamboo in their yard. Someone else had sailcloth. So together they created this. People donated rugs and pillows, and then they operated it together. They took it out into the rest of the city to facilitate public gathering anywhere where it was called. This is the most famous and beloved vehicle in Portland, Oregon, for sure. And it costs a whole lot less than a Porsche. But it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. It really goes anywhere. Here it's in a park setting in Laurelhurst Park. And you can see that they've set up the candles around it, and it's just coming to twilight now, and the Persian rugs and pillows have come out from the truck, and people, all these neighbors are bringing chai and tea and different desserts, chocolate cake. It's really the most fabulous mobile tea house you've ever seen, I think, or you'll ever see. But the idea is that people who haven't had a chance to say hello to each other, to build social capacity where they live, get a chance to come outside and interact with their neighbors and just to say hello. Here you see it's kind of coming back to its launch pad at the first intersection project where the neighbors have come out for a potluck to sit underneath the shelter in case it rains, which it, you know, hardly ever does in Portland, compared to Los Angeles. Okay, so that's all good stuff. I mean, what we're doing by doing that project is we're helping everyone to know that this intersection project has happened. We're also giving people practice in learning how, sort of relearning how to work together to create a mobile tea house or a highly aesthetic sense of place. Like the truck shows up, and in 15 or 20 minutes, it's all set up and the wings are splayed out. So that's all really great stuff, but what it adds up to over about a year and a half or 2 years is it travels in this great counterclockwise circle around and around the inner city on a 6.2 mile loop going through about 15 different neighborhoods, and it spans both, you know, the east and west sides of the city, you know, over the Willamette River, and then it also spans between the north and the south part of the city, and it's sort of trying to reunite the metaphorically speaking divided four corners of the world, or the divided four corners of the city. And then at a certain point, this event happens called Hands Around Portland, where thousands of Portlanders come up, and they link together, spanning through bridges and winding through all these neighborhoods. And the idea is to say, you know, our place, our turf, you know, that this can have a cultural utility, that we can get together by the thousand and not have to pay a ticket, and not have to be watching some competitive sporting event or something. And here you have, down at this end of this roadway here, you have the commissioner in charge of transportation leading everyone on this spontaneous blockage of the lane. And he's being quoted on live radio saying, the most important thing we can be doing right now is reclaiming the commons. And he's leading everyone out on this sort of spontaneous insurrection. But, you know, none of that's important compared to this, where, you know, every child on the route, as far as they can see to the left or the right, they see other people standing, you know, and blinking up, treating each other with dignity and respect. And again, you know, is this not about sustainability, enabling children to have new choices, a different awareness? So the tea horse is a great idea that was picked up by homeless kids, and they created what's called the tea pony. Of course, it's smaller, stronger, faster, better, all that sort of thing. They designed it so that all the connections could be done so easily that if you just know how to tie your shoe, you can help put it together. So the wings and the struts and all of the connections to the truck happen just through tying bow knots like you tie your shoe. And then it adds up to this fabulous environment. But it's a project between City Repair, Cascade Aids Project, you know, organization.